Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is the founder of the Raygun newsletter, Tim Murray. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Hi.
Now, we're going to talk about what the Raygun newsletter is, for those that don't know, and we're also going to be discussing three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. So, without further ado, let's start with the first most obvious question. What is the Raygun newsletter?
The Raygun newsletter is I would say weekly, but it's less frequent now, but it's a trade email newsletter for what I would call the video industry, but is a slightly outdated term now,
yeah.
Probably the home entertainment industry and wider film industry as well. The Raygun was launched about 13 years ago, 2010, I think I launched. But I've been a trade journalist covering predominantly the video industry since it was still called the video industry.
So when you say video industry, you mean the boom of the VHS?
Yes, yeah. VHS and Betamax as was. By the time I joined, Betamax was dead. I joined in about 1990. I think something like that. And I've worked on various trade magazines, some of which closed in the in about 2008, 2009. And lots of people in the industry kept trying to persuade me to come back and do a what ended up being an email newsletter. So I've been running for 13 odd years, breaking stories, covering.
I was going to say, so what's a typical leading story for the Raygun newsletter? Let's give people a picture of what it is.
It will be, we'll talk about the business, what's doing well out there, what's selling well, what titles are on the way, forthcoming titles. We'll talk about box office and what's doing well at the cinema, because obviously that will all run into home entertainment eventually. We've obviously been tracking physical media and where that is, because we are... Although we write about digital releases, we're less so about streaming. We still cover the streaming market, but we're still very much wedded to physical media as a concept, both on a personal level and on a professional level as well.
You know, so this is about sort of promoting the idea of to the people who are going to be selling film to people that buy it. This is what's coming.
Yeah, we're going to retailers. I mean, it used to be a lot wider retail base than it is now.
But
we go to HMV. We go to some of the supermarkets that are still stocking it. We go to a lot of online retailers as well. And then various people across the industry. You know, we have a kind of wider brief, or as I see it, a wider brief. We're trying to enthuse people who work in the industry about the industry, to make them feel part of something, to make them feel part of a community. Certainly over the last, you know, during our lifespan, physical media's obviously had a bit of a kicking national newspapers were always kind of down on DVD and Blu-ray in the latter years, kind of what I call it a get with it, daddy-o kind of viewpoint, saying, you know, hey, kids, everyone should be streaming now. What are you still doing with physical media? And so we wanted to give people in the industry something to feel proud of and feel part of. So we're trying to kind of create a community. Although I'm a long-standing journalist, 30-plus years, it's written in quite an informal, chatty style as well. And we cover, yeah, so essentially we're trying, it's a combination of the interesting and the important, you know, important facts for people in the industry, but some interesting stuff as well. We're trying to, you know, work all on the same side. What I always say is it's kind of like having an independent voice. Yes, the studios and distributors will always be telling retailers how brilliant something is and how well it's going to sell.
Yeah.
We'll try and be an independent voice within that. I'm kind of the last man standing now in the home entertainment trade press. When I started, there were three weekly magazines. Still going, which slowly went down to kind of two monthly magazines by the end of the 2000s. And is now just me kind of thing. I do other things in the meantime. I'm editing a toy magazine at the minute. So the ray gun's now more in my spare time. But I love the industry. I'm a big fan of the industry, big fan of physical media.
Well, I was going to say, Tim, then in terms of physical media, and obviously this will go out in what you would call the run up to Christmas, which will be a big time for in the heyday of physical media. But,
yeah.
But in terms of the sort of jungle drums of what's going on with what's coming out physical media wise, as we hit the holiday period, as it were, what are some of the exciting titles that people can look forward to in terms of physical media?
Well, there's going to be the summer's big theatrical hit. So Barbie's on the way. Oppenheimer's on the way. Obviously, they'll be digital first, but will then be physical media as well. Those have obviously, those two biggies have driven people back into cinemas. And I think they'll drive people back into stores. I think you'll find that some of the, I'd be almost certain that many of the supermarkets or some of the supermarkets who no longer stock physical media regularly will be putting standees at the front of the store with Barbie on it.
Yeah.
And that will kind of help people get back into home entertainment. I think it's been a good year for horror. So something like Talk to Me, which is an outstanding independent horror film.
Yeah.
We'll still be there. And there are still all kinds of gems and treasures that you can find. There still is a DTV market that's kind of worth doing and that's worth looking at. And there's little titles there. And I think that there's a film I'm just watching at the minute called Little Bone Lodge, I think, which is going to be on Blu-ray in October.
Right.
And that's a crappy little film. And I think, and then what you've also got is what I'd call the boutique labels, who appeal solidly to the collectors, people like Deep Breath, Arrow, Arrow Studio Canal,
Severin Films. Film. Severin Films, David Gregory's label.
Yes, yeah. The BFI are releasing some great titles, and you're seeing Eureka, a couple of newer entrants like Powerhouse and Radiance Films. There are a lot of these labels now who are mining everything from old black and white obscure film noir through to 70s Italian horror. You're starting to see people bringing out kind of what would be straight to video films, but with big video rental hits as well, in kind of really nice Blu-ray versions, 4K versions, complete with booklets, lavish packagings. And that's a really big thing now. And it's not so much the amount of units they sell, but they are all limited edition. They all tend to sell out.
So in a way, the physical media for film has gone the way of sort of vinyl, hasn't it? It's really just aimed at its collectors as opposed to a mainstream market.
I think there is an element of that. There's still a mainstream market. And it's always been traditionally VHS throughout the 90s and DVD from 98 onwards has always been a great gifting option. Certainly with the British public, more so than a lot of other countries. You're still seeing it's still a market that's worthwhile. I think you're starting to see physical media, some studios exiting. But there are studios now in the UK that are kind of putting their products through third-party distributors and things like that, and that proves worthwhile for them. It might not be worth the studios doing it, but for an independent to do it, they can still turn a profit. I mean, they have to look at margins and so on. But it's still a very vibrant, worthwhile market. I think the UK has always led the way in packaged media for home entertainment.
Okay.
In terms of films, the UK was always, I think, ahead of the US in how it marketed, how it bought these things into stores in terms of what it did with the packaging and exciting ways of presenting it, you know.
Brilliant. So if there's any sort of industry folk listening in who don't know about your letter and want to get hold of it, how do they get the Raygun newsletter?
They can just drop an email with subscribe in the header. You don't even need to say anything nice to me in it. Just put subscribe in an email to info@theraygun.co.uk. The Ray Gun being entirely as it sounds, which is the, and then Ray Gun, all one word.
I'll put it in the show notes so people can get that themselves.
It's also just as an incidental, in case you ask, in case anyone's interested. It is called the Ray Gun because at the time we launched it, I briefly ended up having what I call as a sabbatical from journalism. And I was working at design agencies, creative agencies.
Okay.
And everyone I was presenting to said, yeah, that's great, Tim, but why don't you go back and launch another something else for the trade, another publication, because I'd already launched a couple of magazines prior to that. And they were saying, you know, come on, please come back and do something like that. That's what you should be doing. So I started thinking seriously about that. And somebody at one of these studios, a big distributor, said that Blu-ray had not long launched. And they said, if you can somehow work Blu-ray into the title of your newsletter, I think you'll get more advertising from it. We'll definitely advertise with you. So I had a list of about 50 different names that had Ray or Blue in the title, and ended up settling on the Ray Gun because we could have an image of a gun as part of the logo, for our own house ads, and we can quote David Bowie's Moon Age Daydream, which has got a great line about keep your Ray Gun to my ear. So I like the idea of that as well. So hence the Ray Gun.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, thanks for sharing that, and thanks for introducing my listeners to the Ray Gun newsletter. I'll put details in the show notes so people can email you if they want to subscribe. And thank you for your ongoing support of physical media as someone who does still buy it, and it will be on my Christmas list, no doubt. But let us move into your three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Without further ado, the clock is ticking, and the first title on your list is 1973's Exorcist. Where are you seeing that the first time you see it?
Well, I was very much a child of the video nasty generation.
Okay.
And grew up watching dubious horror films on VCRs. Initially, for the first few years, it was around people's houses who were kind of the early adopters. I had a few mates at school and friends whose parents had bought into that boom. My old man was a massive film fan, as it was. He spent his childhood and teenage years going up to Leicester Square and hanging around at film premieres. That would have been kind of 1940s to kind of get autographs. He's still got, somewhere there's an autograph collection of his, of various UK and some visiting US film stars. So very much in the blood, as it were. But so The Exorcist would have been 1979, was one of the first films I ever saw on video. It was around a mate called Ian's house, and they used to have the video man come and see us. So the first part of the evening would be, we'd go around Ian's house, which is over the road from mine. We would, a guy would come around with a suitcase. I think even rental stores weren't really that prevalent there. And I know it was 1979 because my old man was still alive and he died early in 1980. The guy would come around with a suitcase of films, open them up. They were of initial probably, annoy a lot of people in the industry because I'm anti-piracy, as many people in the industry are. But they would have definitely been hooky films of some form or another. And one of the ones we chose, because we'd all heard of it. So this was before we started kind of going deeper into the world of video nasties and
the pre-cert.
Yeah, but this was this would have been The Exorcist. This may have been a legitimate cassette, actually, because I think it had come out by then already.
I mean, it's worth remembering. Yeah. It's worth remembering and telling people actually that for the younger people listening, is an original copy of a VHS in 1979 is going to be upward of about £100, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Ironically, an original preset copy of The Exorcist on VHS now would cost probably about the same or even more. You know, there's a big collection.
Because really, the studios weren't that sure that home entertainment was a thing, was it? Or they didn't want to entertain it because they thought theatre was it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They were worried about piracy and the potential of that. Video in those early days always had a very seedy reputation, which the studios didn't necessarily like. They thought it tarnished their films and their brand. And they didn't like it because they couldn't control the means of distribution. Mm. It involved third parties. It involved independent video rental stores who they never particularly liked, who were generally founded by more predominantly working class entrepreneurial people.
Your mom and dad stores. I mean, I had about three in my town.
Yeah. Mom and pop, as they call them in the States. And the kind of rental model, the video rental model came about because that's how consumers like to do it. And it happened in spite of the film studios, which always kind of annoyed them. So we got The Exorcist. We rented The Exorcist. We watched The Exorcist, and it absolutely terrified the living daylights out of me. I was absolutely petrified. We, using the then exciting new technology of rewinding and pausing and slowing it down, we watched the bit where she is stabbing herself in with the crucifix and uttering all kinds of obscenities. And it was rewinding those and listening to what she was saying, the blasphemous obscenities that really kind of affected me. I didn't even get anywhere near the end of that story there at all.
Finish your story off. Go on. All right.
Yeah. So, I remember going home, didn't tell my parents I'd watched this film. I took the dog for a walk around the block, and I remember being absolutely terrified by this. And then, I mean, that was kind of my introduction to video, and it was something I just thought, this is brilliant. This is brilliant as a format, as a concept. And then throughout my life, I've ended up, I've written about The Exorcist. I wrote about The Exorcist in 1998 at length, when it finally was given a certificate by the BBFC for home entertainment release. There's a 50th anniversary edition coming out this autumn from Warner, which I will again be writing about. So it's kind of been a constant throughout life, as it were.
Yeah, and did you come down to the Fright Fest screening of it as part of the 100 Years of War?
No, I didn't make... I spent Fright Fest a couple of visits down, mainly in the Imperial pub around the corner, seeing people. I was there for the 1998 theatrical re-release. They held a screening and a party in somewhere in the West End, at one of the West End cinemas for it. So I have both seen it on the big screen. I've watched it numerous times on home entertainment formats as well, obviously.
Well, let's just move on. And I should say, we are going to stay in the horror world for all three films, for your choices. And for your second choice, I think it's safe to say for the British market, and probably the same for the States in many ways, this was a true kind of VHS hit. You know, I don't think many of us would have seen this at the cinemas in any mainstream sense. And this is where VHS opens you up to a world of cinema you couldn't even begin to know existed. And I'm talking about Romero's Dawn of the Dead from 1978. So if you're watching Exorcist in 79, when are you watching Dawn of the Dead?
Dawn of the Dead would have come along a few years later. I can remember watching a lot of these films in absolutely vivid detail. I can remember whose house I saw them around more often than not, who we watched them with, who was there. Can't remember exactly what year it would have been. It would have been a couple of years after this. I mean, we really immersed ourselves in it. I didn't get a VCR...
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals.
Save big money at Menards.
Family home until 1983, so it would have been somewhere between 1979 and 1983.
So, what was the venue then for that point of view? And if you didn't get them,
I think it was almost certainly around a chap called Andy Pryor's house.
And what stands out for you? What stands out for you from the viewing?
Obviously, the key moment for us, and it was another of those great VHS moments, which you rewound and watched again and again, was Helicopter Zombie, as the zombie gets the the top of his head kind of chopped off by the helicopter blades. And again, that moment alone was an absolutely seminal moment. It was a kind of, you know, it's that perfect film in that, and the reason it stayed with me so long is that it was gory. It had all those elements in it, but it had, you know, it was so much more than that. Mm. It was the kind of film that you'd used when you were trying to tell people that horror was more than just guts and gore. Mm. Although there was a lot of that in the film, that there were a lot of kind of social messages in it, and it actually, was viable as an art form, as a form of commentary. And I think that was kind of that was a really important film for us. For me and friends, and you look at it, and similar to all my choices, really, I'm a big music fan, and over the years I've seen Dawn of the Dead countless times since. I've seen it live with Claudio Simonetti, Goblin, doing their soundtrack.
Oh, really?
That's Union Chapel in Islington. That would have been about 10, 15 years ago. And so it's still that kind of film that has stayed with you throughout those years. Mm. Again, in my job as a kind of home entertainment journalist writing about video releases, I've written about Dawn of the Dead countless times. I now, as well as doing the Ray Gun, I write, I wouldn't say essays because I always think that sounds a bit pretentious, kind of long-form journalism. I write a lot about the history of the home entertainment industry and specific films within that. So for when Second Sight, the wonderful Second Sight label, released Dawn of the Dead in a lavish box set a few years ago, I wrote a lengthy feature kind of charting the history of the film at theatrical and VHS. I spoke to someone who worked or in fact, I think ran the distributor that originally released the film at theatrical, a chap called Neil Abram, lovely guy, whose son, Neil later went on to launch a company called Arrow Films. His son, Alex Abram, now runs Arrow Films, or more pertinently, Arrow Video. And they've ended up releasing a lot of films like this and these great classic horror films in lavish editions. So I wrote a length for the. So it's kind of, again, it's another film that's really been a constant.
What did you find you were saying? What did you find you were saying there when you given the opportunity to write about this film? What were you able to say?
Well, it was less what I think, and I'm not a film critic. I'm a film journalist. I'd say more than anything else.
Right.
So I was talking to Neil and various other people about the film, the initial releases, the problems it had at the time with the BBFC, its history within home entertainment, and the various releases over the years, and which bits were cut and then later reinstated to the film as. Yeah. Kind of, yeah, you know, in a post 1984 Video Recordings Act world, the BBFC were a lot stricter, and slowly they've let people get away with more over the years. But
I was going to say, I mean, when you look back to that time and think now what can just be on TV, let alone what gets released, it's amazing to think that we were in such a panic. But that, you know, you talk about being able to rewind a film, but actually that was a big revelation, and obviously that was power we never had before. Which I'm guessing the powers that be, that's what they were scared of in many, I mean.
Well, yeah, I mean, James Furman was always very hard on what he'd call imitable violence. And imitable moments, you know, I know there's been films cut before when they've shown in great detail how to break into a car.
Hmm.
Or they've shown someone breaking into a car. And that is something that people can then copy and do. And there's certain elements of drug use when you're kind of quite clearly showing how to mainline smack, for example. Yeah, you know, that's something that people can essentially copy. And yeah, I mean, over the years, you've seen the BBFC has become what I'd say would be a lot more sensible in terms of how it lives. But I think there's how it works. But I think there's a lot. you know, it's still this thing that hangs on. So now nearly it's 40 years since the video recordings act next year. Someone was telling me that for an independent video label now to release a film on Blu-ray, say, £2 of the cost of that goes to the BBFC.
Wow.
Whereas, you know, streaming companies don't even need to get a certificate of any shape or form. So they're inherently going up against this draconian legislation that came in nearly 40 years ago that is now not fit for purpose at all.
Right then, for your final choice, we jump to 1982. I think it's safe to say this one is a VHS classic in the sense of it bombed at the box office and was critiqued quite a lot because people really just wanted E.T. They didn't want an evil sci-fi story, of which obviously the thing is, from 1982. Do you want to talk about what it means to you and why you picked it?
I mean, it was a toss-up between two John Carpenter films.
Okay.
Which Assault and Precinct 13 was another huge film in video terms, massive video hit, you know, and the UK really helped make that film to the level that, as legend has it, John Carpenter told the boss of the UK arm of Vestron in the 70s, who initially released Assault and Precinct 13, when its success in the UK fed back into the US, John Carpenter said to the boss of Vestron in the UK, you know, thank you so much for this. I'm going to name a character in my next film after you. And that boss was called Michael Myers. And, that was where the name Michael Myers comes from. His son, Michael Myers' son, Martin, still works in the film industry, does sales on that side. Assault and Precinct 13 is probably the film I've seen more than any other film in my life.
Oh, wow.
I've countless times on VHS. I've seen it on 16mm, 35mm, various things like that. Massive John Carpenter fan. The thing had an equal impact on me because it was the first X film, or well, it was the second X film I went to see at the cinema before the age of 18. The first was my mum took me to see One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest when I was 15 and looked about 10 and told them that she was my mother and she knew I was 18, so they needed to let me in. And she was a magistrate. She gave it the whole, I'm a magistrate, I wouldn't do anything illegal. The next one I saw at the cinema was The Thing, which I think, as I remember it, I just kind of just altered the date on my birth certificate to help me get in. I don't even think I needed to show it in the end. I still looked remarkably young. It was a huge influence on me just because I loved the film so much. Watched it numerous times on VHS after that. I'm a big, you know, I said earlier about being a big fan of physical media. I'm a I wouldn't say record collector so much as I've amassed a vast amount of records, and particularly vinyl. So in the I've written about The Thing numerous times I've watched it go from VHS rental, and then in my career I've seen it go from various different price points on VHS, various different repackagings. I've seen it go right through to being released by Arrow Video on a gorgeous Blu-ray. And I've got the soundtrack album, which I think was Waxworks Records, I'm saying, that was some huge limited edition with, you know, lavish packaging and sleeve. And the same with Assault and Precinct 13. I now own pretty much every John Carpenter soundtrack going. And these films were just hugely important. I think within the genre world, everyone loves John Carpenter. You know, I've been to see him live doing his whole synth thing. These were just hugely, and I remember at the time, and you're saying, you know, as my memory of the critical reaction to it and the box office reaction to it is, no, it wasn't that it wasn't that successful. It was kind of pretty much dismissed as being a bit hokey, sub-alien kind of thing. Mm. Although, again, the reviews at the time for a 16-year-old would lead me down into Howard Hawks and things like that, because they said that, well, it's not a patch on the original, is it? So there was just a lot kind of in it, really, for me to glean. And yeah, the soundtrack, the kind of the combination of Morricone and Carpenter kind of led me down that kind of, it led to another path of getting into soundtracks, getting into this kind of thing. Yeah, and obviously, again, it's a film that stayed with me throughout, because I'm still writing about The Thing in the same way I'm still writing about The Exorcist and still writing about The Dawn of the Dead, kind of 30, 40 years afterwards.
What do you think is the enduring nature of genre films like this? What are they doing that means that they're not just vanishing? I mean, obviously, plenty of films were released around this time that vanished without a trace. So why do you think these still hold their own today?
There's always been I think the word of mouth element, certainly for John Carpenter, has always been really strong.
Hmm.
And that word of mouth would have started, you know, something like The Thing. For me, it was this perfect combination, because it had gore in it. It had elements of horror and sci-fi in it. It had this amazing soundtrack. It had an incredible wardrobe in it. You know, people I know who are in the clothes and so on, and various kind of Facebook groups and on Twitter will come winter, will always stick up a picture of Kurt Russell and co wearing their full kind of parkas and Arctic outfits. But it's a word of mouth, and also always an element of self-discovery, I think. And you know, I when it comes to film history, history is written by the winners, and there's a lot of films that maintain their status because they were successful in certain ways. And then there are films that will rise to the top just because they're great films, really. And I think The Thing is one of those that yes, it didn't, you know, it found its audience over the years, and this audience grew and grew and grew.
It's quite a unique thing, that, isn't it, for a film to sort of endure, because it wasn't taken as seriously as it is now when it was released. Whereas, I mean, The Exorcist was up for Academy Awards and all kinds, so there was no doubting its pedigree when it hit home entertainment. And Romero following up Night of the Living Dead, a seminal horror film. You know, you've got the whole kind of commentary on consumer culture, literally consuming ourselves, and so on and so forth. Whereas, you know, The Thing came, like you say, hot on the heels of something as successful as of Alien, and then more recently had the kind alien like E.T., And this thing just seemed out of step, didn't it? I guess more than anything else.
Yeah. But they're a great, and I think part of its enduring appeal is certainly you watch it now, and I've watched this with my eldest son a few years ago, and as a rite of passage almost. And the effects, you know they're not CGI. You know that they are. Created on the set, as it were. But they still really stand up. You know, they've endured remarkably well and still look amazing.
And let's be honest, The Thing is literally the most amazing baddie villain, because it isn't anything, it's everything that's living. And therefore, how do you defeat it? It's
which
such
is
a clever,
kind of,
simple idea.
Yeah. And you know, it tied in with a lot, and I love the kind of bleakness of the ending, the certain open-ended nature of it as well, which kind of very much fitted in with that, the kind of consensus of opinion at that time, and those kind of bleak ending films that was a hangover from the 70s, as it were.
No, I think that's a good thing. Well, look, sir, we've come to the end of your three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. That's a nice little journey we've been on through the early 80s of your watching career. Thank you for sharing that. It's and given you've been writing about the industry for 30 years or so, and been a fan for longer, one question that sort of springs to mind for me to ask you before you go is, sort of, What's the most significant change you remember in terms of the home entertainment industry? What have you seen that's been the most significant change for you?
I would say a few things. You know, the launch of DVD, and I remember going to Warner Brothers' old office in Wardour Street, just near the Blue Post, on the corner of Wardour Street, where Soul Jazz Records is now, Sounds of the Universe Records, on that big building on the corner, and sat in an office, and they showed me The Fugitive on DVD. And I remember being blown away at this time, and you kind of got this feeling that you were seeing the future. I think that was one of the biggest moments. I think a few years after that, in 2003, was when, again from Warner, when they invoked the European Rental Rights Directive. I think
that
was essentially a rule that said they could have two-tiered pricing. They were putting a lot of Warner had always bought our titles, what we used to call straight to sell through, or straight to retail, as I preferred. So with films like Batman, that came out available to buy before at the same time as being available to rent with $12.99 RRP. But what the Rental Rights Directive said is that Warner could sell a film to Woolworths and Tesco's and HMV for £10, and they could sell it for whatever they like. But at the same time, Warner could also sell that same film to a video rental store for £50, even though it's exactly the same film. And a rental store couldn't go into Woolworths and buy a copy of that film and then rent it out. They had to rent a copy that was for rental only.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was kind of the beginning of the end for the rental industry, really, in the UK and elsewhere. And, you know, the launch of DVD, everyone will know about that kind of element, just had this huge sweeping change. And that was the beginning of the end for the rental industry. There were lots of other things as well.
It's amazing how quick it's happened, because if you think about your 1979 story, I mean, Blockbuster didn't open its first store till 1989. So that's a good decade of sort of us evolving into what became the VHS rental industry. And then by the end of the 90s, you get the DVD and George Lucas insisting his film must be digitally projected, which again was two digital things happening at the same time. And then the last 20 years, it's like been on steroids, the rate of change. You know, you think, certainly the last 15.
Somebody said to me recently, a friend of mine who's been in the industry for as long as I have. No, you've been in the industry longer than I have. But he said that he will, that he will spend his entire adult life working in an industry that didn't exist when he was born and will no longer exist by the time he dies. You know, it's an incredible, this journey of physical packaged films and media. You know, it's got longer left than many people anticipate, and I think it's got a good few years left in it.
There's some real anomalies, isn't there? Because, I mean, I was reading up on it, and it showed you that, like, even though the late 90s is when the DVD arrives, DVD doesn't overtake VHS until 2009, which already it's then already too late anyway, because streaming's about to happen within 2 or 3 years of that.
It may have been earlier than that, certainly. I mean, DVD was incredible because it quickly became the fastest growing.
It was popular. I'm not saying it wasn't popular, but in terms of rental markets, it didn't completely swamp out, because people still had VHS players.
I've still got VCR, and I've still got quite a few tapes and so on.
You do surprise me. Well, look, sir, I'm going to have to draw this to a close. Thank you very much for joining us on the Britflix podcast and sharing your three films and talking about the Raygun newsletter. I'll put details in the show notes so people can contact you should they want to receive the newsletter. And it just gives me to say thank you very much for being a guest.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me. It's been an honour and I've really enjoyed it. Come on,
time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.